Welcome to the Stoic Handbook podcast. This is John Brooks speaking. First of all, I just want to say thank you so much for being a member of the Stoic Handbook community and taking the time out of your day to listen to my podcast, read my newsletter, and put the ideas to practice to level up your practical wisdom. If you're a fan of my work and you want to support the show, you can sign up to the premium version of the Stoic Handbook podcast. You can either do this directly from within Apple Podcasts, or you can go on stoichandbook.supercast.com. When you sign up to Stoic Handbook Premium, you'll get access to my existing library of Stoic meditation and contemplation courses. I make each course about a specific emotional topic like negative thinking or anxiety, relationships, anger, etc., as well as workshops, exclusive Ask Me Anything sessions, and ad-free standard episodes. There's a 7-day free trial, so you can check it out, see if it's good for you. I'm always adding new content, and I take a lot of time to craft my courses to make them as high quality as can be. One of the listeners of the Stoic Handbook Premium told me that they listened to my anxiety course over 50 times. People often like to go through them over and over again. So like I said, you can check it out, see if it's a good fit for you. It's this podcast, plus a bunch of premium episodes, meditations, talks, workshops, etc. And I also open up the space for questions as well. If you want to talk to me and get me to record a podcast episode on a specific topic for you, that's what Stoic Handbook Premium is there for. Now let's go into today's episode. Justin, I've at this point, I think I've lost count about the number of conversations we've had. I know we've done like 3 official kind of podcasts, and we've done a few other things. We've done a video on reading, and we even have, I think, some lost tapes, some like unreleased dialogues that I'm going to be releasing at some point. I want the focus of this conversation to be about health. Now, when I first met you, you were introduced to me as like a learning expert, like Eric Brown, a mutual friend, was like, I met this guy and he's like a learning expert and he's memorizing all these things. And I was like, okay, cool. That's interesting. But then after talking to you, learning is only a small part of kind of what you're interested in, right? There's so much. I mean, I don't think I could talk to you about a topic. I don't think I have actually, where you've been like, sorry, I got nothing on that. There's always like something, there's always something you could bring to the table, pretty much anything, actually. There's like a huge breadth of knowledge there. And recently I've been picking our brains on cardio because I have a jiu-jitsu competition in a couple of months. And I was like, yeah, Justin talks about cardio a bit. I'm going to start asking him questions. And then it became like this whole program. And yeah, and you're kind of like my Wikipedia for cardio at the moment. So I guess I kind of, to open this up, I want to ask you, what is your personal relationship to health and fitness? And, you know, why, first of all, is it very important to you? I think I kind of know the answer, but, you know, and if so, why is it important to you? Why do you spend so much time prioritizing it?
I mean, I think to answer that question in the beginning, it's important to say, like, I'm a nobody when it comes to, you know, this topic. I'm just a guy doing his own exploration. And, you know, you mentioned some very complementary things. And I think the easiest way to say that is that there's a weakness in every strength. And definitely one of my strengths is that I do vast amounts of research according to a certain framework of like, how does this mechanism work? And what are the biggest levers that I can pull on this mechanism as well? And so I approach my entire life like that. You know, anything that just picks my curiosity just a little bit, I'll dive in, I'll try and understand mechanisms, how it's influenced, you know, where it comes from, all that kind of stuff. So really my background was a place of ignorance, to say the least. And to say that, like, in the last 2 years is where I've really seen a lot of my results come in is phenomenal. I could kick myself for some of the crap that I did when I was younger. Like, you know, it just wasn't the right amount of volume, or, you know, I wasn't doing the right exercise for the right area, or whatever it is. So, my approach to this, to say the least, is that the mind and the body are one. You can't separate the mind out. If you try and understand what the mind is just a big bundle of nerves, but those nerves permeate everything. And one could argue that the nervous system is the self, because the nervous system is what tells the muscles, the body, the heart, the lungs, the organs to do certain things, you know? I mean, it's a little bit more complex than that, but I'm sure you're getting my analogy of like, you know, there is this concept of embodied cognition, which is that, you know, your nervous system runs throughout your body. It's not just localized in your head and that's where it stays. You know, there's impulses that run throughout your body that will inform everything that you do. And there's a breadth of research and knowledge that says that, you know, when you contract your muscles start producing all these like signaling hormones that go into things, which recruits all these other things and start signaling other things that happen in your body. And the end result of pulling that lever is increased memory, increased cognitive function, you know, increased clarity, decreased brain fog. You know, just yesterday, you and I were sending audio notes back that said that people who exercise and have bigger muscles, they're less likely to respond to the, you know, the classic, you know, diabetes sugar test as severely as someone who doesn't exercise, because the body just knows what to do with that sugar, with that glucose when it hits. And so it's just this idea that I think my approach and the way that I connect with it is almost like hygiene.
Yeah.
It's almost like a mental hygiene. The idea of, you know, flexing your muscles. Most people are like, oh, you got to choose a goal, like a body fat percentage or this. That for me is irrelevant. And it goes more to like a process-based thing of like, you're going to brush your teeth? Great. Why are you brushing your teeth? Oh, because I've got this goal of having perfect teeth or like getting the girl with my beautiful smile. Ding! You know, and it's just, no, it's hygiene. You know, you can enjoy brushing your teeth. You can hate brushing your teeth, but you still do it. Yeah. And there's ways to kind of get around that. So I think hygiene is the best way that I've heard it's being described, but I would say it's hygiene that you really enjoy as well.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I love that frame. So it's for you, it's more just like a, like you give me a reason not to do it. Almost. That's the kind of vibe I'm giving you. Like, what's it, why wouldn't I do it? As opposed to, I need a bunch of reasons to do it. Same as brushing your teeth, if you use that analogy. Okay. So could you share a little bit about how you first became interested in the sphere of health? Because just to give listeners some perspective, you're not just interested in, say, cardio or something like that. From my understanding, and maybe you can clarify this, you're interested in almost every metric, you know, whether that's VO2 max, strength, like every health metric you can think about, including sleeping, flexibility, right? And I'm sure the list goes on. But like, how did you start becoming interested in that? And what was the journey like?
So it was quite interesting because, you know, my background is that my dad was a very famous dance choreographer and teacher from South Africa. So I grew up around a, you know, a physical culture, shall we say. But South Africa is also very sporty and things like that. And then my own personal approach was that I was involved in a lot of water sports, kayaking and sailing and rowing and, you know. And it's like any kid, anyone, you know, you usually have an introduction through games you play, sports, any kind of competitions. And I eventually took it into martial arts. And with martial arts, like I didn't care about being the biggest or anything like that. It was always about like, could this person take me or could I take them? And, you know, when you're skinny, I used to be so thin and, you know, so lanky that you could, you know, a stiff breeze would blow me over. But I was hiding almost behind this thing. My identity was rooted in this idea of like, I'm superior in the ways of martial arts and therefore no one is ever going to best me. And it was rooted in identity. And eventually I started at the age of 25, like suffering pains in my hip, in my shoulders, because all I was doing you know, the martial arts without any kind of conditioning, strength and conditioning work. So then I started getting into more strength and conditioning work underneath you know, my godbrother and his tutelage. And now he's like, he's one of the top CrossFit athletes in the UK. Like he ranks on their numbers and their boards and things like that. Yeah. He's a monster. He's a monster. And even then he's like, you know, compared to other CrossFit athletes, you know, he would say like, he's not even a competitor. But yeah, he is incredible. And so he was then pushing this kind of stuff on me as well. And the approach basically comes at, oh, I get exposure to this concept and this person and this idea. And I realized at some point, I'm like, just let's all cut the crap. What is it that I'm trying to do? What is it that I'm trying to achieve? Why do I want to achieve these things? And it was that time that I started doing much more research into, okay, what are superfluous kind of things? What are nice to haves versus, wait, what are the necessities? And this way of approaching things is what I then started infusing in my work. What are the broad strokes? And so the broad strokes for everyone, in my opinion, from my perspective, from all the research that I've done, the broad strokes are like, health means nothing unless you're getting adequate sleep. But it ties in, because if you're not doing exercise, your sleep is going to be affected as well, because you still got like a lot of sugar running around in your system, for example. Just one of the things where it might not work so well. So you've got all these stats around sleep and how sleep's affected. But then the second marker is going to be nutrition and food. And then we start going into like, okay, what are the physical interventions? And the physical interventions, as far as I classify them, are then going to be your exercise interventions. After that, you've got breathing interventions. And after that, you've got these types of like stillness frameworks as well. Now, within exercise itself, I would argue that you've got, skeletal, muscular kind of resistance training. Then you've got cardio. Then you've got flexibility. And those are going to be micro strokes inside the broad strokes already. And so, yeah, I think largely what I settled on after years and years and years of like looking for the perfect approach and being influenced by Tim Ferriss's like optimized way of approaching everything. And, you know, like, holy crap, I can do this one exercise and become like a deadlifting god, you know, just one exercise from 20 minutes a week. Like, pardon my French, fuck optimization.
Mm-hmm.
Optimization usually leads you down a very narrow path where you have a lot of fragility. So, okay, forget optimization. What's a broad approach that we can take that's still ticking boxes, that still gives me a framework that I can utilize? So as soon as I stopped saying optimize, 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 you know, and to be honest with you, that's also where you see a lot of like social media come in today, where influencers are famous. Why? Because check out this new exercise where this person is doing this weird movement and like, can I do that movement? And those movements that are really catchy are usually like accessories or a blend of two movements together. And if you zoom out, what's the broad stroke movement of that? Oh, it's this simple movement that if you're not doing that movement, you have no business doing this very specialized movement anyway.
Right.
So yeah, I think those are, you know,
yeah. Wow. There's a whole like system and a framework that you have there. I want to circle back to what you said to start off that. And you made quite a bold claim, actually, to the effect of something like, I'm paraphrasing, but like health means nothing if there's not adequate sleep, something along those lines. Is that right?
Yeah.
I love the fact that that's so bold, because it's sort of like, what I'm hearing from that is like, prioritize sleep before you even talk to me about health. Like, if that isn't important to you, good sleep, we don't need to be talking about lifting or cardio. If like sleep is something you can just kind of, if you're drinking caffeine in bed and trying to get by on 4 hours sleep, mm-hmm. we can't be talking about VO2 max at that point. That's kind of what I'm interpreting that as.
Let's be honest and let's be inclusive. And yeah, you can talk about like VO2 max if you're getting bad sleep and things like that. But
yeah,
at what price? What's the consequence, you know, of that? And I would argue that usually like athletes and people whose job it is to exercise are probably the worst people to go to for advice, because they will give you a system of winning and optimizing for winning. And the price, the consequence that you'll pay is usually going to be your body as well. I mean, I've known professional dancers whose feet and knees and back are like things that they, in later on in life, in their 40s, their career stops, grinds to a halt. Why? Because that system is a system of performance and feeling pain for your art. It's amazing how many dancers have that perspective of like, you know, it's okay to bleed for your art. I'm like, sure, I guess. All right. You know, whatever you want. And that's the beautiful thing about human expression, is that the best system means nothing unless your passion's in it. So yeah, let's be inclusive about that. But let me cycle back and give you an example, John. I've got a client at the moment who is trying to round out all of their health. Okay. Sleep is in the tank. Sleep is absolutely in the tank. So 5 hours a night. My client's got a Whoop. So able to tell me, you know, particular metrics on this kind of data. You and I have had discussions like, my wife's got the Oura Ring. I've had the Whoop for a year. She's had the Whoop for a year. I'm using the Apple Watch, at the moment because of, you know, what the measurables, how accurate the data is. When do they measure data? Things like that. So I'm very much like in the loop on this type of stuff. I do enjoy it. But I don't let it dictate me. This guy's data, broad strokes, it starts with quantity. How much sleep are you getting? And so anywhere between, let's say, 7 to 9 hours is more or less what you need. That's fine. Mm-hmm. That's your sleep need. This guy's getting like 5 hours, 4.5 sometimes. So, okay, cool. What does your food look like? Not enough calories, not eating enough calories, and not eating enough protein. So whatever your feelings on diets are, you know, like as a macronutrient, he's not getting enough protein. And obsessed with training, wants to train even harder and harder and harder, and is maxing out like his active calories. I mean, he's doing like 3,500 calories of, burn per day. I mean, you know, calories is a rough metric anyway to believe in, but this guy's sleep turns out to be, he is not eating enough in order to get quality sleep. And he's not eating enough protein to actually feed his body. So there's a lot of issues that are going on there. And the prescription is don't exercise, actually. Prioritize your sleep.
Right.
Because once you balance out, you know, once you can get yourself to a foundational stable level of homeostasis, then we can start adding stress to it. But if we just start adding stress to his body, it's a matter of time before things start breaking.
Right. Okay. And what are the kind of, seeing as we're talking about sleep, what are some of the suggestions you're giving your client that could also be applied to kind of the general population that also struggle with sleep?
I mean, a lot of the time it's going for this idea of quantity first, then we can start having conversations about quality and frequency. So most people are like into the data, just like I was, just like I guess I am, you know, like, oh, how do you increase REM sleep? And what's your ratio of REM to deep that you need? And restorative sleep is a blah, blah, blah. And the answer is, unless you're getting the quantity of sleep down, the rest doesn't matter. The rest doesn't matter because quality will be dialed in after you get the quantity, and the consistency of quantity matters more. So unless you're getting your 7 to 9 hours a night, there's no need to have more of a conversation and looking at, well, what's stopping you from getting that 7 to 9 hours? Okay, what interventions can we put in place? I mean, there's all the typical ones about like having a sleep oasis, like my friend likes to say, you know, where your room is sacred for sleep. You have your bedtime routines, things like that. But then we start to tie in. I mean, I mentioned to you the 5 physical factors. I talk about them as harmonies. You can harmonize with your exercise. If your sleep is suffering, what does your exercise look like? Because chances are, if you're over-exercising or under-exercising, we've got something that we can change for you to be able to sleep better.
Yeah.
Right? What does your breath work look like? I know someone who did like Wim Hof's breath work before going to bed because he thought it would relax him. And I'm like, are you crazy? It's hyperventilation. It's like, like this is like the opposite that you want. You know, what are you doing? You know, food as well. Some people, I'm in this camp. I can eat food before bedtime and it will actually increase my restorative sleep, my quality of sleep. Everything just goes up. All the metrics go up. Whereas my wife, if she has anything, if she just even sniffs food in the like 3 hours before bedtime, it'll disturb her sleep. Like you cannot believe.
Wow.
So it really is something that is quite personal. And so I find that this is quite a little nugget here. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these things are iterations, and personal responsibility comes into it with this idea of like, I need to find the iteration that really connects with me at this stage of my life, in this season of my life. So it's always going to shift. There's never going to be this set structure that I follow. It's always going to be like, oh, I'm finding that this works better for me at the moment. So I'll stick with that at the moment. Oh, this isn't working anymore. Let me see if something else works better for me. So this iterative approach, and if you ever speak to someone who's trying to get into health and fitness, they'll outsource their iterations to someone who tells them, this is how it is. You do 3 sets of 10 of this and this and this. And of course, when they fail that, because it doesn't speak to their personal preferences, their personal idiosyncrasies or their passions, you know, they're like, oh, it just wasn't for me. I'm just not an exercise person.
Yeah.
Instead of taking that approach of, this is something to iterate. It's a beautiful thing for me to learn to, so I'm going to sound very American here, dance with instead of dance. Something to dance with. Yes.
Speaking personally about sleep, since having these conversations with you and tracking, which I want to get into shortly, I've started prioritizing my sleep more. And one of the things I noticed is that, you know, if you're used to something, you know, the example that comes to mind is like Mike Tyson was used to being broke. So that when he made 300 million, he still found a way to kind of get broke after that, you know, just kind of the pullback of habit and identity. And I think I've just formed this identity of someone who is often sleep deprived and does often burn the candles at both ends. And now it's like a bit weird for me to just not be that person, you know, even though it's like I could go to bed now and I am tired, but in the past, that hasn't stopped me. And so like a weird kind of like, I have to kind of like do it. And then when I have a good night's sleep, I feel amazing the next day. It's like nothing stresses me out. Everything bounces off me. I'm like bulletproof. So then when I wake up, I'm like, why don't I do this more often? You know, this is so, you know,
I mean, this is that's a great question, John. Why don't you? Let's ask this question. What does it mean? Well, like if a person like works hard and they sacrifice sleep, like in your mind, is this person like, do you attribute good qualities, bad qualities, or neutral qualities to this person?
At the moment, now I associate negative qualities to them. I think as well, just to kind of round out that question, I think I've had bad sleep partly because of my environment of having a young kid and kind of getting used to it, almost like it wasn't a choice for a while. Like when I was a teenager, I would lay in and sleep late and I would always kind of get my good sleep. And then you make a bottle in the night and you kind of, it's like normal for me to be sleep deprived. That's me. And now it's like, I could probably have better sleep now, you know, and it's like a weird shift. So yeah, it's a good question. But now I'm definitely starting to see that, like, what am I doing? You know, sleep is so important and you can really feel it. Like clearly when you sleep well the next day.
100%.
Mark, do you have any input?
Yeah, no, all kinds of interesting things I'd love to ask about. I mean, specifically related to sleep, I was curious when Justin mentioned breathing as being related to sleep, because I wouldn't have, yeah, food, exercise, that makes sense. But when, obviously Wim Hof breathing before bed doesn't make sense, but I instantly wondered, is there a kind of breathing that does facilitate better sleeping? And I was just curious about that.
100%. I mean, let's use this framework again and talk about broad strokes. And the idea is that, let's say you're being chased by a cheetah, you know, in the savannah, you know, that old chestnut, you know,
classic.
And what's your breath work going to be when your sympathetic nervous system is really activated and you're super stressed out? You're like, you know, basically you're taking in huge gulps of air for fuel. A lot of your breathing is out of control. It's in your chest. It's very short breathing. It's very loud breathing. And if you look at the extreme opposite end of the spectrum, you've got someone who's like super relaxed. What is their breath work, you know, going to be? What is their, the sound of their breath? Where are they breathing into? Like, what is the cadence of their breath? You know, and basically we can say that anytime that we can take control of the breathing, the heart rates and therefore, you know, all the other things after it, like blood pressure, you know, these types of things are going to come into flow with that. So we have control over our breath at times, and then at other times we don't. So when we're talking about breath work and we're preparing for sleep, I mean, imagine an hour before sleep, you do 15 minutes of breath work where your goal is to just breathe slower than you were breathing the minute before. Calm yourself down. You know, very light breathing. And so I always promote Patrick McKeown's breathwork stuff for anyone who wants to learn about this kind of thing. I made my own like heart rate variability resonance breathing track on Insight Timer as well, based on some research about skewed resonance breathwork, which actually opens up the mind. So you've got breathwork there to be cognitively aware. Now, that would be bad as well for bedtime. So bedtime is usually about calming down the breath. You know, it's lengthening out and focusing more on the exhales in order to bring the heart rate down. So there's a type of breathwork. I actually do this after cardio as well for heart rate recovery. You know, in the 2 minutes after you finish an exercise, you should watch how many beats per minute does your heart rate actually drop. And a faster drop usually means better recovery. And so you can actually teach your body to do that faster by focusing on the exhales and the exhale holds. Short inhales, longer exhales, short exhale hold as well. And you'll just notice that your heart rate drops pretty quickly. I've done so many recordings, you know, just that I share with my clients, like on my phone, where all of a sudden you see this heart rate in like the 160s, and all of a sudden within a minute it's like choo, 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 choo. And I'll stop the recording when I get down to like below 100 beats per minute, you know, and I've just been out for like a run or something like that. So definitely that would be the breath work to promote.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I definitely want to go and learn more about that for sure. And then the other thing I was really curious to ask you about, Justin, I mean, have said later, it's hard to derail the discussion now, and it's been focused on sleep too much, but I was really interested in asking you more questions about the mind-body connection you mentioned just near the start. I haven't spoken, that was really fascinating, but I'm not sure quite exactly the question I wanted to ask was, but I definitely have an awareness that a number of people kind of consider themselves to be a mind kind of walking around in a meat suit, and I think a lot of people can feel disconnected from their body. So if I had an awareness of this kind of mind-body connection and I did feel disconnected from my body, how would I kind of change that such that I was feeling that more strongly or better? Or how would that be? And maybe optimize is the wrong word in light of what we said already, but how could I increase my sense of that mind-body connection if I'm new to the idea?
You know, that's a great question, Mark. It really is a great question. I'll speak to it from the lens of my wife. So, John, you know, Mark, I'm not too sure you know. So my wife, Lori, is a registered dietitian. Okay. She's associate director of clinical nutrition at this huge hospital here. She has 2 master's degrees and she's a functional medicine practitioner of gut health. She literally heals people's guts, like people who are experiencing pain and bloat and like they haven't had solid stools in years, and you know, they always have like acid reflux, like the worst of the worst. You know, people who like vomiting, you know, has just become a regular thing for them because they can't hold food down or something like that. You know, so it's really how do you feel the mind-body connection when you feel like your body is working against you the entire time? And it's you feel like you're at war with your own body. You know, these are very difficult things to get over. And I think that to shift your perception on that is a tough thing. The starting point, I think, would be that there is a holistic solution out there. So if you are not suffering from like a malady, a particular illness, a particular thing, it's worth getting to know your body in particular. And that means challenging the assumptions that you're making, about what should and shouldn't be. Oh, but I should just be able to eat blah, 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 blah. Well, I don't know. If you're like me, you got, you know, celiac disease because it's genetic. And you and your dumb, dumb wisdom decided to go vegan for a while and that just triggered celiac disease in you. Congratulations. Irreversible celiac disease. You know? Hey! But now that I own that, I'm very happy without gluten in my life, which means no pizza, no pasta. I'm like, no skin off my nose. I actually don't mind because there are gluten-free options if I want to eat like that. But it actually, the worst thing that happened to me became a blessing once I reframed it. And I was like, oh, you know what? This forced me to explore this avenue that I was not interested in the slightest. And so it becomes that as well. Sometimes, you know, we have to experience that trauma to then be forced to look down a particular avenue. And I think that that would point at just this question of awareness. So once again, it's challenging assumptions. It's raising awareness, asking yourself questions that matter, like what matters to me, you know? So with exercise and training, it was always body weight that mattered to me. Always body weight. Whereas my brother cares about lifting heavy, heavy weights. That matters to him. And I couldn't care. Like, he's like, oh, I just got a 400 kilogram deadlift. I'm like, that's an insane amount of shopping that you are preparing to pick up. Come on, like, just do two trips to your car. You're fine. You know? But it's passion. And so awareness helps that in an immense way.
That's a great question, Mark. And yeah, love that answer. I have something that I want to talk to you about, that kind of extreme weightlifting thing. But before we get into that, I'm curious if you could just talk a little bit more about what you've learned from your wife. Like, what ideas did she kind of introduce you to or help you flesh out, you know? And because it's kind of, you are literally married and living with someone whose like successful career is nutrition and health, right? So it's kind of perfect in a way, because you love this stuff. And I guess you have loads of conversations about, you know, these ideas as well. So yeah, it's curious.
Our romance actually started when I had just learned about like the personalized diets, which was, you know, out of, I can't remember where it was, but these guys were saying that like people's blood pressure, blood glucose levels respond differently to different foods. So you give some guy sushi, blood sugar skyrockets. You give a different guy sushi, blood sugar's fine and stable. And so everybody needs to test themselves. So at the time that I met my wife, you know, I actually revealed to her what a dork I was and what a nerd I was with this stuff, with a spreadsheet tracking my blood glucose levels every 30 minutes. I was pricking my finger. This is before the days of like continuous glucose monitors that you just tack onto the back of your arm. And here's Justin with this, like, these pens, you know, the little lances and like tons of needles to like prick my fingers every 30 minutes of a day for 3 weeks, and coming at that with that data. So, you know, that's when she was like, oh yeah, we're going to get along great. So I would answer your question by saying the two biggest things. The first thing is, it took me a while to kind of figure this out, but once I was able to speak to it, it made sense, and I could predict her answers everywhere. And I think that that's really my strength, is being able to kind of like map out a certain sense of logic or a system, and then being able to speak to it. Her logic is, how do you stop toxins from entering the body? Period. That's it. You know, so as a nutritionist, the toxins that you put into your gut are going to have an effect, no matter what they are, right? So, If there's a risk factor of an effect, don't eat it. Don't eat it. You know, there's no benefit to eating it. Why would you eat it? It's this idea of like benefit versus consequence. There's no benefits and there's potential consequence. Why are you putting a toxin in your body? So, you know, people, there's a bit of a debate at the moment about vegetable oils, and people who are very health conscious are like, don't eat vegetable oils. And, you know, I don't eat vegetable oils. I don't include them in my diet. Because I live with someone who considers them to be, you know, toxic. And there's a lot of people who are like, oh, it's fine. You're not going to grow cancer just from like having some vegetable oil. It's fine. It's true. You're not, but you're still introducing a toxin into your body. You know, there is still going to be an effect, and you still need to detox that. Your body still needs to work that out of your system somehow. How is that going to happen? Are your pathways open or blocked? Blah, 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 blah. So I think this idea of like, you know, knowing your choices and knowing what are you letting in was the first major idea. And then on top of that, the second major idea that I think I really got from her is portion control.
Right. You know,
and that's helped my weight like you can't believe. And when I say portion control, she just asked me, she's like, are you eating a serving? How many servings have you had? I'm like, what are you talking about? Servings? What do you mean? Like, I'm not full. I'm still hungry. Come on. And it's just this idea of, what's the ratio of food that you're eating in comparison to, you know, like what you can actually handle. So I don't know about you, but I can finish off an entire can of Pringles if I wanted to, just rah, one shot.
Yeah, okay. Easily.
And then the next day, my guts would not be happy with me and I'd be on the loo, right? Whereas now, I don't eat Pringles anymore, number one, because of the oil situation. But, you know, we still have you know, some healthier alternatives that are cooked in like avocado oil, for example. And, you know, I'll actually measure out a serving and my stomach is happier for it, for me measuring out a serving. The love handles, sure, if I, you know, if we want to go that route, sure, you know, that helps that too. But it's just more the idea of like the gut. So I think those are the two, you know, minimizing toxins coming in. And then number two is portion control and just being very aware of portions and not just eating whatever I wanted, however much I wanted. And I think that speaks to something about the perception of agency and self-control. And, you know, the more you agency is very interesting. You know, the more money you have, the more control you feel you have. Sure. But the more control over yourself and dominion over, the more agency you feel you have as well. So people sometimes flex their control about themselves in very unhealthy ways as well. And I find that this is more of a healthier way of feeling in control also.
Yeah, I love that. I just had this idea that for most of us, the portions that we eat are decided by other people, you know, like when you buy something out or you get a meal at a restaurant, it's not you that decided the portion. They give it to you. Even like when you eat from a bowl, it's like, what's the portion till the bowl gets full, right? That's the, like, you didn't really decide that. It's just like the bowl told you how much to put in there. Yeah. And you're saying like, empower yourself and you be the decider, you know, of what portion you want to have. And
you know, it's interesting that you say that because I'm 6'2", 180 pounds. What's it, like 82 kilograms, essentially.
Yeah.
And my portions compared to my active calories, which is just an estimate, my portions are like 1.5 times the size of my wife's. And now we can eyeball that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. She's pretty good at being able to eyeball calories according to portions because she's been doing it for like 20 years. And so what I'll do is I'll just take whatever she's eating times by 0.5, you know, like plus another half, and that'll be more or less, I'm good with that.
Yeah. Wow. And can you give us some examples of what you would call toxins, just some kind of basic things to get started with, to look out for, you know, to avoid toxins in what we eat?
Sure. The four that I usually tell people with a brain that are going to make the difference. Yeah, this is one of my pet peeves, is when these like learning experts and people telling you how to get rid of brain fog, and they're like, eat avocados, it's a superfood, or eat blueberries, it's a superfood. Like, you can't say that unless you've done a blood panel and you can tell that this person is like deficient in this particular, like, it's not going to work like that.
Yeah.
You know, yes, whole foods are better than, you know, processed foods, without a doubt. But I've got four that I tell people to stay away from in particular, which is vegetable oils because of inflammation, and inflammation leads to brain fog. So it's all brain orientated and thinking orientated for me. The second one is sugar and the impact it has on the hippocampus, right? Gluten, same thing. And then the final one is alcohol. So those are the four that I tell people to stay away from. What I know my wife would say, and these are the broad strokes of nutrition that I recommend to most people anyway, is first of all, whole foods based. That's it. You know, are you eating something that our ancestors from 200 years ago would identify?
Yeah.
You know, it's that simple. And most of the times that means not eating ultra processed food. So it doesn't matter if vegan, paleo, da, 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 like, yeah, you can throw whatever label you want on it, but what's the broad stroke? Is it whole foods? Straight up. You know? And then you're automatically avoiding a ton of toxicants. Now, you and I have gone back and forth on this and like, oh, the body will break it down for sure. But the gut, the effect that it'll have on the gut, like the body's amazing. The body will absolutely do its job. But the residue that it leaves behind, the effect that it has, you know, on the working parts, you know, that's just our kind of perspective on it as well.
And I appreciate that you bring up the gut element, because I've heard some kind of top, you know, well-known PhDs, coaches online talk about how they are not gut experts, and there's actually still like a lot to learn and discover about gut health, And it's still in this process of like, just because you've got like a PhD in nutritional science doesn't mean you understand the gut inside out. It's like this whole other, almost like alien entity that we're still kind of figuring out and developing ideas as we go.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. Like, there's been so many connections between like the guts and the brain as well. They call it the gut brain axis is, how much of an impact it has. So we talked about that embodied cognition, the fact that the mind is in the body, like your biggest cranial nerve that actually leaves the head is the one that's connected to the gut as well. You know, there's a straight up, I don't know if it's the biggest actually, sorry, maybe I misspoke, but there's a huge nervous connection between the gut and the brain. And
when we experience, I don't know about you guys, but when I experience anxiety, anger, I don't feel it behind my eyes. Like it's like in my body. Yeah. it's like that tension. I personally carry stress. I think I might have mentioned to you before, like in my diaphragm kind of area, you know, that's where you throw in some sleep deprivation and some stressful events. That's where there's this sort of buildup of like this big knot kind of thing that's the area that it is, which is, you know, linked to gut and I would imagine and things like that too.
Yeah, it's interesting where we keep, I mean, like I can't speak to this. I think this is a topic that I know a lot about like where do we hold stress? Sure, physically. But I think that, you know, the whys and the mechanisms are like, this is beyond my ability. Congratulations, John, you found one area.
Until next week.
A lot of the research in there, like I'm not such a fan of, you know, where it's like, oh, if it's in your stomach, it's related to your, you know, your second chakra, which means that you're blah, 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 blah. I'm like, let's see the data on that, please. You know,
you mentioned one of the toxins as alcohol, and I first of all, I want to get your own kind of personal. I'm curious about your own personal relationship with alcohol and smoking as well. Like, let's include smoking and alcohol and marijuana and things like that. You know, that kind of collection of quite popular narcotics that people use. Mm-hmm. What is your own relationship with that? And how do you think they ought to be used for maximal health, longevity and things like that? Like, just what is your opinion on people using them?
I mean, if the objective is maximum health, maximum longevity, the answer is take them all out.
Right.
You know, we got to think about like, what are the use cases? Like, what is this going to be good for? You know, you could make arguments about like social lubrication for a lot of these things. You know, the smokers are more likely to actually talk to one another, you know, in asking for like cigarettes, lighters, things like that, than non-smokers. Smokers also take more breaks than non-smokers. But, you know, that's just like, oh, well, because I'm not exercising, what I want to do is do this insane other thing instead, which would, you know, kind of have this effect where I would meet people. Like, what? This is insane. Like, what are we doing? Like, yeah, I'm going to hit myself with a hammer. In that way, when I'm in the emergency room, I get to talk to people. Like, no, just go to the gym and talk to people. You know, it'll be fine. Right. So I think, look, that's a bit vague and a little bit, let's say, out there. So let's bring it back and let's just talk about it from my relationship was I was a 30 a day smoker until I was 25.
Yeah. Did not know that.
Yeah. I was a hardcore smoker. Like, it was my identity. I was like the smoker. I could do all the tricks and blow the rings and like swallow the cigarettes without it burning me. And, I was very much invested in being a smoker. There was a lot there. I drank until I was about 18 and I decided to stop drinking as like an experiment and it stuck. And I haven't had a drink in now 23 years-ish, maybe more. Yeah. And I mean, you know, when you're younger, you miss it a lot more. But as you get older, like, you know, socialization doesn't necessarily revolve around alcohol in the same way as it does when you're younger.
Yeah.
And it's affected me. You know, sometimes I was going on a, I was being set up by friends with a woman before I met my wife. And I was like, hey, let's go for coffee in the morning. And she's like, why are you saying coffee? Why don't we just go for a drink at a bar in the evening? And I'm like, I don't drink. And she's like, I don't think we should meet each other. What?
Wow.
She's like, drinking's a part of my life. I'm like, that's fair, I suppose, you know? Yeah. So yeah, I don't think that
it worked out. Just
yeah. Then. Oh, it worked out. You know.
Yeah.
It totally did. Well, so yeah, to ask like, what are you optimizing for when you're drinking alcohol to see that there are no benefits essentially? Any right. benefit that you can say like, oh, but what about all of the, you know, the parabens and the, you know, in the wine and all of that? Like a handful of nuts can give you like double or triple what you're looking for in the wine. So like, are you making an excuse? You know, social lubrication. Okay, but that's also a skills-based approach. Like I need Dutch courage to go and talk to someone. Surely you should work on your courage or, you know, practice talking to people instead of relying on a drink. So it's almost like, you know, a crutch or support. Same with like marijuana. I needed to relax or, you know, I had an ex that always told me like, I can only engage in intellectual debate if I've smoked a little bit, you know, I have a bit of a toke, you know, and then I can talk to you. And then I would talk to her and she would just sit there glazed anyway. So like no points. Like what have we done?
Wow.
You know, you went from intimidated to just like catatonic. This is great. So, yeah.
So with the, I don't think what you're saying is controversial at all about smoking, right? I mean, I think, you know, it's quite well widely established that smoking is just unhealthy. Alcohol, I think, excessive drinking, binge drinking, for sure. I think everyone would agree that's not healthy. Some may argue like a glass of wine with dinner or something like that is, has some health benefits. But I think what you're suggesting is that those health benefits could be gotten a different way. And it wouldn't come with some of the negatives as well. But the one that's sort of a lot of people debate is the marijuana use, you know, like some people would say that, it's a medicine and it's, you know, it's like, it has all these properties and,
you know what? Yeah. I was wondering if that was going to make a show. So, okay. If you look at the science, like don't follow me, like Andrew Huberman, Stanford research tenure professor, you know, and you listen to his ones on alcohol, his ones on tobacco, his ones, you know, there's so much data that suggests that none of it is useful, but you don't need another blowhole on a podcast telling people what they can and they can't do. But what is usually a better way of doing it is to say broad strokes and challenge your assumptions. So if a person's having like one glass of wine, you know, broad strokes, is that a bad thing? No. You know, cigarettes, if a person smokes like one cigarette when they're stressed out or something like that, which happens once every 3 months, is that a problem? No. The problem is the repetition. The problem is the cadence of it, the frequency, how much or how frequently are we then having one glass of wine with a meal? Because if you don't have the skills to be able to deal with certain issues, that's what is going to happen, is that you're going to start relying more and more on this. And this is my argument against things like psychedelics and psychedelic therapy, as well as psychedelic tourism, which I know that both of you have experiences with and can speak to a lot more than my experiences. But my experience is that when I find people who do it once and then they don't develop the skills to maintain or to help them cope with life, they'll just collect the same amount of, I don't know, negative habits, patterns, you know, bad processes, and be like, oh, you know, when I last got relief from this was when I smoked marijuana, went on an ayahuasca journey, or like took mushrooms. I'm going to do that again so that I can feel some relief from this thing. And so that I would say, you know, if you're listening to this, challenge your assumptions on if it's your choice or not. If it's something that you're using to basically give you a break, or if it's something you're using to truly push yourself forward. If you're using it to give yourself a break, like, oh, I just feel so like clogged up with life. I just need to connect with Mother Aya again. You know, I just feel that beauty and that warmth of that connection. Like, again, that's where the challenge comes in. Like, what are you doing? You're creating a cycle of dependency. You know, you have, and my modus operandi here is skills, not pills. Focus on the skill work more than anything else. And that's what I would invite people to consider, is like with marijuana use. Yeah. You know, it's not gonna kill you. But if you do it regularly, not only is it going to, you know, bring up your probability of death, number one, but number two is that it will have long-term cognitive issues, right? Impacts. And then number three, it's going to impact your ability to deal with things anyway without it. You're going to need it. It's going to start to become a dependency. It's not a drug like heroin is that hooks you with that kind of a dependency. This is much more of an emotional skill, a coping mechanism, a strategy, dependency. You know, oh, I can't calm down without it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. This is some really good stuff. So one of the, I think you'll appreciate this, Justin, and Mark, you can chime in next if you like. But one of the ideas I had related to something like an ayahuasca retreat. So I was thinking about it, and say someone goes on an ayahuasca retreat in the jungle. If you take away the actual ayahuasca, if you look at like their now the kind of health factor of their week there or 2 weeks there, they're going to bed when the sun sets. They're waking up at sunrise. They're sleeping in pitch black. They're eating whole food at specific times of the day, right? They're cut off from the internet. They're hanging out with people that like show their best selves to them and gives them a lot of attention and hugs. Mm-hmm. Like surely like this is almost like the perfect health environment. And I'm curious to what extent that actually influences the, that was the best week of my life. And I feel so rejuvenated because of that versus just like, it was the ayahuasca, you know, and obviously that's mm-hmm. that's memorable, and the experiences that people can have on that ultimately is the thing that changes them, right? It's an experience that can make you think differently. But yeah, no, I did think that because when I've been on different types of retreats, I just felt so healthy, you know, and just so good and pure. And that I think was just the lifestyle of being more tribal and valuing health. So yeah, curious what you think about that.
I agree with you. I think Burning Man has got a great word for this, which is like when you come back to real life after your travels and things like that, they call it decompression. After you've gone from Burning Man, which is a what's called like psychologically, it's an emotional stroking rich environment. People are very nice. People are open, inclusive. And you go from that environment, let's say like I did, to London, to North London, to Tottenham, you know? It's not exactly an environment where people are like, good morning, how are you? What's your name? Give me a hug. Nice to meet you. You know, or the people that are doing that, they usually haven't bathed in a few days. You know, they've been on the streets, you know, a couple of gallons of white lightning first, you know, first thing in the morning. So let's just say that the decompression is a real thing. Yes, 100%. And the travel, the trip, you know, the brain studies that have been done on changing location to be able to access different mental states is significant to show that just change where you are. So travel is a fantastic way of doing this as well. And like you say, the experience, can we separate it out? I also think that bonding is something that's quite interesting with connections with humans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like if we're taking ayahuasca as the example, you know, it's not a pretty picture. It's not exactly like, oh, I was at a party and, you know, decided to do a little bit of ayahuasca with the wife. And, you know, it was a great evening. You know, we went home and just said, no, like what, puked your guts out and like had to mop it all up the next day. Like, no, you know, yeah, it's really exhaustive. It's not a pretty picture. You know, there's a lot of like physical trauma that we can say just very, you know, acute momentary trauma, very short-term trauma. And people bond through trauma. Having gone through something like that with someone else, you know, it's this shared idea of like, I've been through this and you've been through this as well. Mm-hmm. And we can talk to that together and people back home won't recognize this also. So there are things like that, but could you replace that with, I don't know, like this hardcore obstacle race or being stuck, stranded in the jungle for 3 days? And like, yeah, you could replace it with a lot of things, which are probably less safe anyway as well. You know?
Right.
So yeah, I think you're 100% right on that, John.
Mark, do you have any thoughts on this? So
I have large quantities of thoughts on this. It's an area I find very interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I think there's so many ways I can go with this one. This can have a long discussion purely on this topic. So I'm very interested in it. But I actually had a question that preceded that. I actually wanted to ask Justin. I'm kind of come back to this. But we were talking a certain amount about avoiding things like smoking and alcohol. But from a nutrition point of view, I suspect about psychoactive substances, you're going to say, you know, therefore mostly avoid in a certain kind of way. But I was wondering on the nutrition side of things, is there something which, again, broad brush rather than specific, but people generally don't get enough of, they could benefit from having more of? Like we're saying no vegetable oil, you know, gluten, those things are potentially bad. But should in fact most people be eating more of a particular food group, or is there something that's missing that could be added?
Yep. Yep. Vegetables.
Just more vegetables. Yeah. Profound, Justin. Profound.
Good one. Good one.
Because they're kind of vegetables, or just all of them?
Right, okay.
Are they good and bad vegetables, or just get them all down?
If you look at like the self-reported stuff, the thing is that you get a lot of people eating meat, right? And so it depends on your preferences with regard to your dietary, shall we say, persuasion. If you're vegan, if you're carnivore, if you're whatever, each one of those would have deficiencies, shall we say. You know, with a vegan diet, you tend to find people don't eat enough protein, because then there's this whole debate about complete proteins and how much of it is bioavailable. So I would say that you usually find those kinds of things, but you wouldn't really know unless you do a blood panel with most people, right? And if you do that, then you've got to take it over the long term, because you could see short-term fluctuations, but long-term trends as well. The only thing that you will see out of long-term veganism is a lot of people failing it and going back to a normal diet. So carnivore is the same thing. You'll see people failing it. The hilarious thing about carnivore, I have to share this, is it's so funny. When you introduce your pet, let's say, to a new diet, the vet recommends, introduce 10% of the food to be the new thing. And when their poop stabilizes, when it's not runny or whatever, and they have solid poops, increase it by 10% again and increase it by 10%. So it's this idea of gradual approach, right? Progressive overload, if you will. Mm-hmm. With carnivore, I keep seeing like all of these influencers who go from regular diets to strict carnivore in a day, and they suffer from like terrible diarrhea. They called it like the carnivore diet diarrhea for 2 weeks. And I'm laughing my ass off, because it's got nothing to do with carnivore, but rather introducing an extreme diet, or like new ways of eating suddenly.
Right.
And so, I find it hilarious. But again, we're coming at this from the perspective of what are most carnivore people missing? Most carnivore, they don't eat enough of the organ meats or like the extras. They just think, steak's fine. Steak's good enough. Like, what about liver? What about heart? What about kidneys? What about the thymus, there's a whole host of things as well that you could be eating from that animal. So it usually just comes down to broad strokes. You got to make sure you're getting your protein, your carbs, your fiber. What am I missing out on? Fats. Yeah. Healthy fats. And for most people, the fiber aspect tends to usually be missing. And the micronutrients that are available, the minerals and micronutrients that are available in vegetables, most people undereat that. They'll eat generally enough protein, enough carbohydrates, potatoes, rice, breads, things like that. Great. Cool. And the fats, there's been this hoorah in the last 10 years about like healthy fats. And now people are eating healthy fats. Great. Wonderful. Congratulations. But vegetables, if you ask people to take photos of their plates and send them to you, like it's nowhere near the like it should be a mountain of vegetables. Vegetables like are no calories whatsoever. They're empty calories. You could eat as much as you like, but most people undereat vegetables, and they are incredibly beneficial.
That's fantastic. I've sort of background processed why I wanted to challenge you with the ayahuasca side. I felt a certain need to try and say, surely, Justin, what about this? What about this making it, a worthwhile pursuit and exploit in defense of the ayahuasca users? And this is what I come up with. I want to hear your rebuttal if you're interested.
Go on.
I'll make it personal. I remember one of my first experiences with ayahuasca itself in Costa Rica. And as John has described, there was, I think at the time, I definitely underappreciated to what extent the benefit was conferred by a week of healthy eating, exercise, and then people and all that thing. I think at the time I underestimated that aspect. But I think the ayahuasca aspect was very big as well. But I was very overconfident after it. I was like, oh, everything is great. Things won't be ever the same ever again. I feel amazing. Wasn't too concerned about integration and stuff. Cause I was like, yeah, no, things, you know, which was, you know, a mistake perhaps. But I remember even, you know, in more difficult patches of my experience subsequent to that, I could still reflect back and think, well, you know, right now things are looking pretty gray and not so good, this particular moment in time. But I could refer back to having seen things from a different perspective and realizing now that even just having had one sort of transcendental mystic type experience, things could look a very different way from how they look now. So I think there's a certain value to be had from even having your kind of perspective radically shifted to a sort of different state of awareness, a different experience of reality, such that even when you're in a kind of less good, less positive place, you could think, well, hang on a second. There was, you know, things did look very differently not so long ago. So actually, my perception differently thinks things more than I think. Perhaps rambling a bit here, but my point I'm trying to make perhaps somewhat ineloquently is that I think some of the nature of that kind of experience, just having it even once, can have a sort of confer a sort of, some kind of benefit, at least by referencing it. Although I completely concede that even though it's not chemically addictive, people can, like you were saying earlier, kind of behaviorally addicted to like, oh, I'm going to, oh, I just need another ceremony and, you know, and keep going on that kind of train. So I've not expressed that as eloquently as I could do, but I nevertheless would like to hear your rebuttal.
No, I don't have, that's like, it's completely valid, you know, everything that you're saying. I mean, you know, the concept of perspective is always interesting where you're like, you're in a bad situation and then you think back to when you were in a worse situation, you're like, oh, it's not as bad as that, I'm fine, you know, or you're in a good situation and then you recall something that can make it better, you know? And so memory is super powerful, 100%. And like you're saying, that having that experience and the perspective that you had during that experience, even though you might not keep it, to be able to revisit it, huge, huge. So if I could offer a rebuttal, here are the two steps to that rebuttal. Number one, put yourself on a scale of -1, 0, and +1, where -1 is something that you're lacking. You're in a state of pain. You're in a state of problems. 0, you're back to basics, but just like a bank account, you don't have anything left to invest in anything else. The +1 is when we start investing in ourselves. And what you'll find is that people with ayahuasca psychedelics looking for answers in those boats, usually they're not in a boat of +1, they're in a boat of -1, which means that it's kind of like the whole gambling addiction thing as well. Like the people who are getting pushed these things on are usually in fragile states, that they're more likely to then buy into, you know, like the latest online casino or something like that, get their 100 free chips and try and like, you know, make all their money like this. They're more vulnerable. And so people who are in like -1 states, psychologically speaking, much more vulnerable. And that's where we see, like, in at least my perspective and the people that I've seen, a large majority of the population who go there, they're looking for answers. They're looking for that thing to fix their lives. Okay. Now, if you then look at, if you look at people going there to get a different perspective, like you're saying, that's great. You know, it is definitely a strength. I forgot my second point. But the first point still stands. This is -1, 0, and +1. And I think that's it. That's my second point. My second point was, if you study memory, every time you revisit a memory, it changes and it changes its shape. And this is why, like, witness testimony on the stand is no longer valid anymore. Witness testimony, you can tamper with someone's memory. You can change the color of cars and things like that. And so by doing work and revisiting memory, you can actually see different things like that. You know, so I would say that the only form of rebuttal here is that you could revisit other memories and actually put perspective on them that makes them something that would serve the same purpose. But in saying that, I mean, like, why do that when you've got a perfectly good memory from your ayahuasca retreat anyway? You know? So it's the only rebuttal I got, but I don't think that it's a rebuttal. I think that your point is entirely valid. I think that it works really well. The only difference being is that I think it would take you out of the moment. That's all. Mm. And I think there's a lot of... The only reason you would need to be taken out of that moment is if you don't have the coping strategies to deal with that moment. But usually that moment that you want to be taken out of is where you should be present.
If that makes sense. I'm sort of in danger of jumping around too much when I ask you questions, Justin, because there's so much fascinating stuff I want to ask you about. I think I slightly missed a bit of the Putin-Lenin connection, a little bit of the portion on stress, right? And you know how I always hanker after the Justin not cheat sheet on things, you know, nutrition and okay. Those kinds of things. Sure. I was wondering if I could try and extract from you the Justin not cheat sheet of stress, but I was wondering if I could, if you'd be willing to let me subdivide that into sort of chronic and acute, right? If I come to you and okay. I'm Justin, I'm like, I'm super stressed right now. Right now, I'm experiencing stress in this moment. And also, if I was kind of long-term, like, I'm just too stressed out. What you would say as the, again, very, very broad brush, you know, not too individualized tools for dealing with stress.
Sure. So this is my system that I usually coach people through is like, do you need relief right now? Like, is the stress you're currently experiencing and is still ongoing with this? In which case you need stress relief. You need to be able to create space from this stress, distance from the stress. And it's about distance and time to give yourself breathing room. So that's step one. Step two is then making sure that you're able to recover from the stress you've experienced so you can go back into stress tomorrow. And, you know, you're not as much in a negative place as you would be, right? So we've got a kind of a stress recovery going on after that as well. The third thing then is then, do we have a stress mitigation strategy? Like, how do we avoid the stress happening from next time? And then the fourth point, and this is the final point, is do we have a stress resiliency program? Like, how can I make it so that the stress becomes irrelevant to me in the future? So those are the four points. It's some breathing room, some recovery, mitigation, and then tolerance.
And what do each of those stages look like? I mean, particularly when you say recovery, I'm sort of, what does stress recovery look like? Is that a sort of relaxing or... You tell me about that.
Essentially, so if you think about stress and what you need to recover from stress, like breathing room from stress is one thing. But let's say like this, if you've got finals week for, you know, university or something like that, you're under extreme amounts of stress. How much time before you bounce back from that finals week?
Might take me 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah, I reckon.
There you go. And that's your recovery. So like if we get dialed in on habits, eating habits, exercise habits, sleep habits, you know, hobbies and interests, that might be able to take the 3 weeks down to 1 week. You know, what does it look like to take control of your recovery process as well? Like there's so many times that I hear people talking about like crinks in their neck or like pain in their shoulder. And well, isometrics is actually a fantastic form of actually healing a lot of these types of things as well. And I say to people like, what are you doing about your injury, so to speak? And they're like, I'm just waiting for it to heal. Like, that's fine. That's valid. There's nothing wrong with that. And there's a lot that you could do as well to kind of stimulate recovery too. So creating space is in the moment. Recovery is after the moment. Mitigation is like that moment is in the past and we're trying to plan for the future. And then tolerance is when you're at that state of plus one, I've got energy to invest in making myself stronger, not just avoiding this, but I can meet it head on next time and it won't even touch me. I have transcended this stress. And that's what I'm obsessed with, is how do we transcend stress, or, you know, that particular form of stress.
Have you found the answers to that question? How do we transcend just stress, Justin? Well, I mean, perhaps I want to ask that, but as a little kind of just a quick one, you mentioned briefly isometrics, and I have no idea what that is. So I wondered if you could just briefly explain what that is.
Sure. So in the broad strokes of like looking after yourself, you've got exercise, right? Skeletal muscular resistance training. And within that, any type of movement has got three ways to work the muscle, right? We've got the eccentric, the concentric, and the isometric. Eccentric is usually the lengthening phase where the muscle gets longer. So think about a bicep curl. As you lower the weight down, your bicep muscle goes from this like this one bulge to like flat. And that's going to be the eccentric phase, the lengthening phase. Your bicep muscle gets longer. The opposite is the concentric, goes into one big ball, okay? And then at any point in time, if you stop the movement and you just hold that tension, that is an isometric movement. Well, it's not a movement technically, but it's an isometric contraction.
To sort of hold it halfway or any fraction thereof.
any fraction. You can hold it at the peak. You could hold it at like the complete lengthened. But anytime you've got tension on your muscle and there's no movements, it's an isometric. And so isometrics are fantastic for healing, mm-hmm. especially if you can bring in like, you know, low percentage activation. So you're not trying to struggle against it. You're just trying to like feel the muscle and make it move, and it's not moving. And you hold that for a long duration of time, 30 seconds to a minute, that can really help you with a lot. There's a lot of injuries here that you see, and a lot of influencers that speak to injuries around different things with isometric treatments. So it's pretty cool.
Fascinating. Yeah, I'm going to have to do more research.
I remember having like almost like an inflamed Achilles tendon that just mm-hmm. was not going for weeks, and resting didn't do anything. And then I found some like rehab program, and it was getting me to do these like ridiculous exercises, like, you know, like involving isometrics. And I was like, this isn't going to work. Like, I need to rest this surely. And it's like pain just went like 15 mm-hmm. minutes later. I was like, whoa, there's something to this. There really is. It was like crazy, because he was really annoying me. So every time I would walk or go anywhere, I was in pain. And after 15 minutes of this rehab stuff, it just went. I was like, okay, it's time to upgrade what I think is possible with the body now. 100%. I have a question for you. It's kind of a specific question about stress. So a lot of time people, when it comes to stress, they deal with like general stress. And, you know, it may, now that I think about it, be in a lot to do with sleep deprivation. You know, maybe they're actually like not sleeping, waking up a bit too early, going to bed a bit too late, and the week goes on and on before the weekend where they drink and kind of pass out, and that stress builds. So there could be just like a general like lack of sleep. It could be like relationships that are just making them stressed out, conflict, certain thoughts that they're having. There's lots of different reasons for stress. But what about that type of stress that is like almost like deeply physiological, that almost looks like a form of Pavlovian conditioning? You know, like, you know, when a like an abused dog just gets like told like stop or something like that. And that you could see the entire system of the dog changes in a second. That's got nothing to do with sleep deprivation, got nothing to do with thoughts that they're having. It's in there, in that system. So I was wondering what you could say about that, and, you know, how one could start to like unravel that and start to build health when they have that kind of conditioning.
Yeah, no, this is valid. The main perspective that I take on the brain, which might be a hot take for some, but for most, you know, neurologists, neuroscientists, it's pretty standard, is that the brain is an automation machine. So I'll say that again. The brain is an automation machine. The job of the brain is to automate whatever you tell it to do, and to do it better. So the brain will recognize patterns and give responses. It'll recognize different triggers in the environment, and it'll give responses. Now, the responses that it's been doing again and again will start to group together into basically an entire clump of responses that just come back as a single response. So the first time the dog gets beaten, let's say, there's a bit of confusion and whatever, but it starts to pay attention to all the environment kind of cues. The environmental cues will then stimulate it next time. So the next time, maybe it's not enough. Maybe the third time, the fourth time, the fifth time this dog gets hit, it now has started to create a pattern, an automated pattern. The dog has no choice in it. Why? Because when we're stressed out, we activate sympathetic nervous systems, things like that. Fight or flight responses kick in. And your brain is going to signal these things to keep us alive, right? And so think about it like this. Our movements in personal development, I call them the three big movements. There are three areas for us to think about. Area number one is self to others. Get over ourselves so that we can give, right? We basically have to take this journey where we deconstruct ourselves and realize who do we want to help and how fulfilling it is to help others, right? Mm-hmm. And it's got to do with the idea of humans as an animal. If we dissect, you know, the human species, we are humans first, and all humans work in the same way, which is we are stronger with a tribe, which is we seek social validation. Da, 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 da. There's a whole ton of things about basically giving to others. So self to others is the first movement. The second movement is short-term to long-term. And a lot of the time, we'll see that type of thinking you know, instant gratification is immature. There's an immature sense about it in terms of like, I'm not being judgmental on people calling them immature. What I'm saying is children. You know, the marshmallow test is a perfect example of this. The children who can delay gratification usually wind up being more successful because they see a point in delaying gratification. Mm. So they practice delaying gratification as well throughout their lives because they understand this type of thing. People with instant gratification usually get themselves into major problems, like emotional instant gratification. If it's instantly, you know, within me to feel gratified, if I express my anger at you for doing something, and I catch you and I start conflict with you and you turn out to be Brazilian jiu-jitsu, you know, son of God, and you turn me into a pretzel, you know, like I know you would, John.
I don't know about that.
The idea is that it was a stupid move on my part.
Mm.
It was a very stupid move on my part. So short-term to long-term. And the last movement is survive to thrive. How do we move from a survival state? So the dog is in a survival state. Anyone who is traumatized in the same way from like violence like that, abuse, things like that, you're going to be in a state where you're sensitive to triggers around you, which could put you back into that state, right? Which is why like, you know, go and see a therapist who is trauma-informed, this trauma-informed therapy, which is about helping people to manage with that, break those patterns and deconstruct those patterns. Now, for those of us who aren't necessarily traumatized in that way, we do also have these kinds of patterns. I've got patterns where people stop talking to me and they walk away mid-conversation because they are, you know, trying to be aloof, trying to take control by not speaking. You know, like if we start fighting and someone goes, oh, and they walk away, It is incredibly triggering. Well, why? Oh, it's a pattern response of attention. And I realize who did it when I was younger. Who basically was the person hitting me as a dog? Yeah. Oh, it was, you know, my mom, my dad, my parents, whatever. That doesn't mean that they're bad people, but I learned that pattern there. A child's brain made sense of the world and decided that this was the pattern.
Right.
Okay. So we've patterned ourselves and we've automated this response. It's a physiological stress and it's our responsibility as an adult to unpack that because no one is going to do it for us. And by unpacking that, we become far more tolerant of stress and almost transcend that stress in the future. Like, how do we replace that stress-based automation instead with a smile-based automation to laugh, you know, or laugh at ourselves, not maliciously laugh like, ha, 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 I've won the argument, you know, but rather this concept of like, oh, geez, I caught myself. I almost flipped out. Wow, I can't believe I almost got caught up in this, like this loop again. Wow, I'm very proud of myself. That's awesome, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that to be said, it's just the automated brain and how we pattern ourselves to respond. And the answer to that, I believe, you can't practice fighting with people. You know, it's not realistic. It's not very healthy either, you know, to just go around picking fights and be like, this is it. I'm going to practice not responding to people when they walk away. Well, good luck. But you can do that with visualization techniques.
Mm.
And so this is what I do promote with people as well. There's that study on free throws. We talked about it before in previous episodes of your podcast where, you know, group number one was told, you know, practice free throws for 2 weeks. Group number two was told, visualize them for the same amount of time. And group number three did nothing. And of course, the improvement that you saw in the group that actually visualized it in meditation was 1% less than actually doing it, which means that in these incredibly emotional pattern things, like we can't practice if, you know, our parents like hitting us or something like that. We can't do that in real life, but we can condition our brains to deconstruct this pattern, to go backwards, you know, to condition a new response and to automate a new response. And so it's this idea of like reps. Well, let's do a rep scheme here. So, I mean, a very easy way to do this is a meditation that I made called the Smile Bank, which is every time I saw a dog, I would smile. And so I practice in my mind smiling at the dogs that I had in memory from yesterday. And this is going back to what we were talking about, Mark, about perspective and, you know, having the memory of ayahuasca in your mind to help you through more difficult times. You've got a memory bank full of things that can make you smile, and doing a certain amount of reps in helping you to then be reactive to your environment in a very positive way, in a way that serves you, because who wants to feel triggered? Hands up. Hands up. Nobody? Nobody? Are you sure? Come on. It's on the table. Anybody? You know? So yeah, totally. Everybody wants to feel good. And so the way that we do that is automating it is my, I don't know. I suppose, Mark, we could say that that's my secret to stress transcendence.
Yeah. I what you just shared about the visualization kind of makes me think that a lot of the Stoic exercises were sort of like visualizations on how to act wisely, you know, like imagining the worst case scenario. It's not just about that. The important part is how you're going to deal with it. And you practice that part, right? That's where you can kind of visualize. It's not just imagine bad things. It's like imagine bad things and then how are you going to deal with it? That's the important part of the visualization, or viewing things from above. You know, you're just practicing being more detached and viewing things from that perspective. You know, you're just running that simulation. So I've always thought of those techniques as like ancient forms of virtual reality training. You're just using your mind and your visualization skills to do it.
Yeah, without the expensive tag of like Apple's new, you know, goggles or whatever. Yeah. 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 Exactly. Yeah. That's 100% it. Yeah.
I wonder if I could just sort of check that I've understood by way of what you were saying with the sort of stressful patterns, right? So would it be accurate to say that in the case of your example you gave where when someone walks away mid-conversation and kind of that's a sort of negative pattern and that is triggering for you, you could then use this visualizing technique to sort of, in a sense, kind of overwrite the existing pattern such that you are no longer triggered. Is that correct? And that kind of understanding of what we've been saying? And the, I suppose you could do this, presumably, you know, obviously an example we gave about, you know, like having arguments with people, that's not a good way to practice in real life. But if it was something that not quite so extreme, could you still also do it by just sort of trying to make a conscious choice to overwrite your previous conditioning, as in without the visualization?
So this is the thing, is that the conscious choice is in the doing. The conscious choice doesn't happen within the moment. So let me put it like this. Okay. If you're prepping for a speech or a presentation, so I've like my number one kind of brag that I can have here is that, a 2-time best-selling author, I coached her to do her TED talk. Now she's already a keynote speaker, is making like $25,000 per keynote that she does. And she books out like 20 a year. It's ridiculous, you know?
Sounds good.
And so I was like, I want that life, please. You know, she couldn't program her mind to remember the words of a 10-minute TED talk. Like, she was having difficulty with that, okay? So the idea there is, if she had gone into stress, like into a practice situation with the same things, cameras on her, people in front of her, that wouldn't have helped. Now, let's say if you're super stressed out as well about speaking in public, more speaking in public isn't necessarily going to do the same thing, even if you're like, right, this is it. I'm going to make a decision. It's not going to affect me at all, right? Because the body responds to signals, not you telling it. So if you want to build muscle, you telling your body you want to build muscle isn't going to signal it to build muscle as much as, let's say, going to failure or stimulating your muscle in a, you know, some kind of fashion like lifting weights. Or, you know, one could make the argument of, you know, just taking steroids and, you know, or follistatin, which is, you know, the antagonist of myostatin. So there's a whole other world that we could explore there. But let me just give you rather a personalized example. How about that? This is what happened. Social rejection. Like I said, people walking away from me is very triggering for me, or at least it used to be. It used to be incredibly triggering to the point where I would be crippled by it. I would be beside myself. And so, you know, this one friend was like, hey, I'm coming to London. I'm like, cool, come stay with me. We'll do all this thing. Great. Day number one, I'm not going to stay with you. I'm actually going to stay with a friend. So, okay. Yeah, sure. No problem. Yeah, that's okay. Sure. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow. Great. Tomorrow comes. Same thing happens. Oh, you know what? I've got another friend in town. I'm going to go stay with them instead of you. And of course, my brain was hearing they're more interested in seeing other people than seeing you, because you're not as valuable. You know, that kind of pattern was running. And I was like, and this happened like 3 or 4 times in as many days. And on the day that I was supposed to see them, they're like, oh, by the way, you know, I'm bringing my friend around as well, and then I'm going to go stay with them instead of with you.
Oh.
And I'm like, I'm just like, you know, forget the friend, the effect that it had on me, I was a 0 out of 10 that day. I was in the fetal position on the floor, crying my eyes out because I didn't know what to do. I was, what is happening to my body right now? You know, really, I have no control over this. I have no idea. And so what I did was, it's called the APET meditation. It's a manipulation from the Human Givens Institute and some of their thoughts. They've got a great book called The Human Givens. I highly recommend it. And I made a meditation based on this. And this meditation basically worked like this. I reimagined a situation where this person was saying to me, Justin, I'm going to go hang out with my friends instead of you. And I played that 20 times and my reaction. And what I did was 20 times I turned up on a dial how viscerally they were hurting me, you know, up to 10 and down to 1 and up to 10 and down to 1 until I was desensitized to it in effect. Okay. Maybe it's not the best approach, but it worked for me to hear this person like spit venom at me. Justin, you're not worth anyone's time. Why would I want to spend time with you? I'm going to go spend time with my friends instead. Mm. Okay. And what I did is I also turned up, and I do recommend this with smaller things as well for people to see, because was my friend actually saying that? No, they weren't saying that, you know? And my response was like, oh, you don't value me. And of course, if you turn that up, that's like, I want to be valued, you know? And you basically turn up like the crying child that wants attention inside you. So you can really see what's underneath the surface of like all the double speak and all of that. And then what I did was I then wanted to keep her like venom at 10 out of 10. And I wanted my response to be returning with like a joyous kind of love, go in peace type of emotion, because that's the only thing that you can really do in that scenario. You want to fight, you're going to turn up anger. You know, you want to be vindictive, you're going to turn up anger. None of that stuff is good for me. You know, it's that whole concept of drinking poison to hope the other person suffers from you doing that. So this concept was that I try to turn up how much I said, go with love. Sure, absolutely, no problem. And part of that was in realizing that this person had no clue, no social awareness to know the impact that was going on with me, didn't check with me. And that came down to her skills. And her skills was basically a level of maturity that was just blissfully unaware of other people in their lives, number one. Number two is that I hadn't drawn a boundary or a border either, you know, a healthy boundary, a healthy limitation to say like, look, this is getting a bit stupid, you know, and being able to deal with this before it got escalated because I was trying to be too nice and polite based on my own kind of automatic patterns. Mm-hmm. But again, this meditation helped me to realize that by role-playing this time and time again and playing with these dials and turning it up and turning it down. And then eventually, what do I want? I want to say, go in peace, no problem, do what you like, big smile on my face, not a big fuck you smile, but like a general, like you'll be happier going with them, so go with them. Absolutely, I want you to be happy, you know? And realizing that also is this idea of like, sure, and you know, like when you've got time for me, that's fine, but you know, like, I'm not going to break my back about it because you didn't break your back about it. So like, you know, let me give into this relationship as much as is being given equally, you know, and just take it from there. And on that day, I went from a 0 out of 10 to a 10 out of 10. I felt great. Not only because I solved my problem, but also because I had found a solution to solve future problems as well. And I've needed this meditation like 3 times since then and done it properly. I mean, like 2 hours of role playing the situation, but a 2-hour fix for almost like a permanent fix in your life.
Wow.
I don't know anyone who wouldn't make that trade.
Yeah. And yet people often don't, like, people don't make that trade though, right? Which is the crazy thing, because of I don't know why do you think they don't? Because most people, they haven't spent 2 hours doing visualizations, even though but there's people listening to this right now that have a specific problem they could work with. You've just given them the technique, you've recommended the book, you even have a guided track on this as well.
I do. Yes.
You do.
Yes. Yeah. So I say that because I've got one that I made a long time ago, which might be a little rough around the edges. I could share it. It's private, you know, because I'm a little bit, you know, like, oh, it is rough.
Got it.
I have made a series that are a little bit better that is inside my neuro resiliency course.
So okay.
I do have, yeah.
Yes. Okay. So you're basically giving people like, you've done the work for them if they want to just have the easy version.
Yeah.
And yet how many people will actually take that leap, you know? I hope that it's more than like that I'm thinking, you know, I hope that it's like 50%.
Well, this is interesting is that you'll find people are motivated when they're in pain.
Yeah.
And when they're not in pain, they're like, I'll do it tomorrow. It's fine. You know, oh, I know where it is. I'll remember this and I'll come back to this. And that's why, like, you know, there's a lot to be said about people who try and invest in themselves on a regular basis. But the ones who try and invest in themselves and say, I'm going to try this today. Okay. I'm going to make a meal out of it are usually the people who are also victims to the cult mentality that's out there where they'll be like sucked up by, you know, the guru out there who feeds people happy wisdom because they were once a monk for a year, but now are millionaires, you know?
Yeah. A skill that I credit some success to, something that I've been practicing is speed of implementation. So if someone recommends like an app or an idea to me, I find that if I can just act on it instantly, as quickly as possible, good things almost always come from that compared to, oh, okay, I'll check it out in a month, right? It doesn't mean you have to like spend hours on it, but you just act on it, right? You just kind of like, right, I'm not messing around. So like, say, for example, you're listening to this podcast. As you're listening to it now, you're like Googling this stuff, you know, like getting on it straight away. Or maybe at the end of the podcast, you've written a little note and you're going to go check out Justin's course or whatever resources he gives you. It's like getting on it without waiting. Even I was on a call actually when someone just was like, hey, there's this thing called Substack. It's meant to be good. I was just like on the call, signing up to it. And that was the beginning of the Stoic Handbook, right? It's just like, do not wait. Just like get on it. You know, only good things will come from it. And I've seen that in other people too.
I think, you know, we were talking about exercise earlier on, and I think this is also like the easiest way to start is, you know, think about it like, what were you doing yesterday? And just do like one more today.
Yeah.
So cool. So, you know, if 2 hours of meditation to get a permanent fix is a little bit much, like try 10 repetitions today. You know, if starting with something that's incredibly traumatic is a bit of an ask, then start with something that's less traumatic and something that you just want to, like, it's annoying for you, you know, so start small and just do it a little bit more frequently and get more like confidence and get more like experience and expertise going, with these types of things.
I wanted to ask a quick question about the sort of potential scope for this kind of guided meditation type exercise in the sense that is it for, I guess you could just answer a little bit just then. I was going to say, is it just for addressing kind of triggering events in your mind, or what is the extent to which this could be useful for?
I mean, consider this. What you're doing is you're training your brain to identify patterns in the environment, and you're telling it what response you want in that pattern. So for example, okay, if I pat myself stepping onto stage and instead of feeling anxiety, I decide, you know, I'm going to turn up that anxiety and be like, oh, don't look at me, you know, don't judge me or something. I'm like, yeah, oh, wow, that's interesting. I've got a judgment thing. Okay, cool. That's interesting. Well, how about I get up on stage and instead just be like, I can't wait to help you or support you or stay, you know, something like that. And then when you're in the real situation, you're more likely to encounter that type of thing. So it could be, you know, in terms of like, programming your own software, you know.
I like this.
And it's this concept of like, okay, what is going to trigger the software? What is going to be the signal that your brain is going to be catching and paying attention to? And then what is going to be the program that you load after that? And so, yeah.
So this kind of cue and then program. Okay, I want to try this, Justin. I'm going to go away 2 hours after this, right? So,
sure.
I want to see if this works as an example, right? One of my fears I want to conquer in the world eventually, you know, when I know I've completed life, is when I will be capable of dancing without alcohol in a sort of in the current environment, without caring particularly anything about it, dancing like a complete Muppet. Because I, as of yet in my life, have been unable to ever do this, right? I get on there, stands for, what can I use your technique to make me, instead of when I get there and sort of feel self-conscious and afraid of what people and myself will think of myself, could I reprogram using your technique so that I am capable of dancing like a semi-normal human being? Do you think? Would it apply to situations?
I don't think anything is going to make you dance like a semi-capable normal human being.
Okay. I agree that was a bit ambitious.
But I mean, like, what does a capable human being dance like anyway? And so, yeah, let's get serious. To answer your question, like, in terms of like fear alleviation, it's like, fine, awareness, identify that fear and practice the cue of being there and seeing the most malicious faces you can imagine and being like, I'm just going to dance and make them smile,
yeah.
You know? And I'm just like grooving and enjoying myself. And like, yeah, you can absolutely get to that point. You can, yeah. How long it'll take you or how much it'll take you depends on the kind of cues that you're running through a lot of the time.
Mm.
Depends on how incredible the fear is as well. So there are things that you can do as well as then, instead of just testing it out at the nightclub, let's say, you could also test it out in smaller ways. Like, let's say run the program, write the script, so to speak, and go and practice it by dancing in front of your family, you know, or something like that. You know, practice it out and see how it feels. Am I running the script or not? What's going on? So you're basically having a couple of, let's say, friendly matches for competition.
I'm going to let you know how this goes, Justin.
I'm excited to hear about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. That's a great challenge. We've talked a lot about the dancing thing, Mark. So yeah, we'll have a follow up.
It's the final, the final boss.
Yeah, definitely. Sign up to John's Substack to find the answer. What happened with Mark?
If this works, yeah, and I'll turn into, you know, I'll turn into like a, you know, someone who loves dancing all the time. People be like, what happened? I'll be like, look at this miracle adjusted method. Yeah, it solved my lifelong difficulty of dancing. Yeah, this is going to be fun.
I know. I the other thing to say is that, like, you know, what is the point of dancing?
Are you asking me specifically?
I mean, this is just a rhetorical question where you're like, in a club, you know, if you define dancing as like, well, I need to be the best dancer that's out there. Well, why? Why do you, like, motivations personally, why do you need to be the best dancer, number one? But number two, what effect is the best dancer in the world going to have on other people around them? You know, it's usually intimidation, isolation. The person's going to feel like, or maybe entertainment. They're going to stop what they're doing and watch. So you're either going to be at best a dancing monkey if you're the best dancer there, or at worst, you're going to be someone who actually makes other people feel less than, right? So I had this whole kind of like approach to dancing where I'm like, I just want to make other people feel at ease as much as possible and get other people to kind of be as relaxed as possible around me. And that was the goal of dancing, right? So the question is what is the goal of dancing for you?
I would like to be able to enjoy it.
Okay. And so here's my question is, do you enjoy it when you're alone right now? Do you enjoy dancing when you're on your own? Forget the club, forget other people. By your silence, I would say that's a resounding no, Mark.
I mean, I was thinking about it. I think, like, occasionally when I'm just in a kind of reasonably good mood, just because I happen to be, and to sort of quite specific music that they would never play in clubs. So, but for the most part, no. I think there's instances where occasionally I've taken it for a spin, but largely no.
I think I can relate to what you're saying because it's completely normal. I think most people are like, how would you dance to that? And how would you dance to that? And how would you, like, what? It makes no sense. I never used to be able to dance to anything that wasn't like two-step, you know, some form of like garage, you know? And even if the beats per minute were turned up too much on dance music, I wouldn't be able to dance to it. Too slow, I wouldn't be able to dance to it. It would be very difficult to find the rhythm of the song for me. And now I don't care. Like, I can dance to anything. Literally, you put on like Tibetan throat singing and I'll like find the rhythm and be like, hey.
Well, in Tibetan throat singing, yeah, let's go.
And it's about like finding like, how can I harmonize with this thing? And that's, like I've mentioned this before, the 10 harmonies. How can I harmonize with my body? How can I harmonize with exercise, my life, my emotions, you know, things like that? How can I harmonize with a stimulus that's out there that is triggering my brain into an automated pattern, right? It's all about harmony for me to get to a plus one state where you're thriving, you're focused on what your gifts are, how your gifts are going to benefit others, as well as, you know, what's a long-term way to dedicate my time? What's a long-term direction I can take? In those ways, you know, you're basically looking at harmony being a key word here that I think flows through all of that for me. And so just the question is, how do I inject my passion for X music into Y music? That's all.
Gonna have to think about this one. Yeah. Any questions, John? Any questions?
So I did, I love all this, but I did want to sort of like, we're in the sort of home stretch of this conversation. I can feel, and I it's really important for me to cover some of the kind of more nerdy health stuff. So, Justin, when I first started talking to you, like, hey, how can I improve my cardio? You asked me, you know, what are you using to track and how are you measuring stuff? And do you have an Apple Watch? And I was like, yeah, I got an Apple Watch. And you said, download the app Athletic. It's like an AI coaching app on the App Store. Yeah. I don't know if, you know, I'm sure there are other variations of this kind of dashboard for your health metrics. And then you give me a run through of like what you're looking for, you know, when you could wake up in the morning, and you talked about heart rate variability. You talked about restorative sleep, general like resting heart rate as well. You kind of like had an overview of your rate of respiration as well, and just your general level of recovery and things like that. So could you just explain a little bit about your thinking on, you know, what, like someone's listening to this, they're like, heart rate variability, you know, like, why should I care about that, you know?
Yeah. And everything is a rabbit hole to go down, and heart rate variability is no different.
Yeah.
It's absolutely a very big rabbit hole. What I would warn people against is heart rate variability is not a metric that is actually accurate. The way that it's being measured and the science and the data we've got on it, I would steer away from heart rate variability. It's good to track it, to know where it is and where it isn't and things like that. You'll be able to see trends. But most of the time, you can't influence heart rate variability because it is it's an aggregate measurement. It's made up of other measurements. So the two that I recommend people pay attention to is resting heart rate and respiration rate upon waking up, because those two metrics will tell you if they're within range, green light. If they're a little bit out of range, yellow lights, be careful. And if they're way out of range, red lights. And what you'll find is actually if respiration is out of range, you're usually sick. If heart rate is out of range, too high, you're usually too stressed. So those are good metrics. And then obviously like good quality sleep brings those metrics into like a nice harmony. And if you want those metrics to stay in a healthy place over time, as you get older, you need to exercise to keep those metrics going well. You need to create a stimulus for your body to respond to get stronger to, you know, that whole concept of hormesis. So the broad strokes, resting heart rate, respiration rate are the two things that you can pay attention to that would really be green light or red light, you know, to be stop and go with your exercise for the day.
Okay. Yeah, that's useful. And just I want to just get your thoughts on this. So sometimes I meet people and they are very interested in self-improvement. They read books, they maybe meditate, or, you know, like they're into this space and it's great, right? We have lots to talk about. But then I'm like, what's your workout routine? Or like, what's your kind of gym habit? So, you know, when's the last time your heart rate went over 140 beats per minute? And they're just like, well, I sometimes like walk to the shop or something. And I'm just like, oh, like, I don't know how you could live like that. Honestly, like exercise is so important for me. I just can't, like, to take exercise away from my life would be a form of deprivation. It'd be a form of like, this is a challenge. You've now got to live without exercise. And I'd be like, I can do it. It's going to be hard, but I can do it. What do you think about that when people just don't exercise? Do you think they're just missing like some obvious important thing, or do you think they can still thrive without it? You know, I'm just curious.
No, I mean, we can see it in our elders. You can see it in parents a lot of the time. You know, they didn't exercise because they didn't have time, or things weren't available to them. The knowledge, the equipment, the locations weren't available to them. And, you know, you'll start to see degradation in terms of range of motion, their ability to do things. Biggest things is balance. And that's why paying attention to people like Peter Attia, who calculates like, how are people going to die and how can we prevent that? You know, and what metrics he pays attention to. You know, there's this idea of like, you don't know what you don't know. So had I been born 50 years ago, would I be into exercise to the same degree? Probably not. Mm-hmm. I'd probably be like at least 10 steps behind where I am today, because there wasn't as much information available. It wasn't normal. It wasn't common. So we really are expressed by our environment a lot of the time. You know, the people who were exposed to exercise were exposed to one way of doing it, which was the way that you were taught, you know, like your traditional way or whatever. So there are a lot of ways of exercising that actually are super healthy. Like, so if you go to Japanese judo, they've got an approach to exercise, which is phenomenal. And then they've got their sport as well. Like some of those judokas are some of the healthiest athletes out there, in my opinion. You know, but then you flip it around and you go to somewhere else and you see their style of training. It focuses only on the technique of the sports, not on physical health or general physical preparedness or anything like that. And you start to see a little bit more frailty kick in. And so people, as they get older, they'll stop doing the actual sport mm-hmm. because their bodies aren't as strong anymore. And so that for me is a sure sign of it. So I think it's just this, again, you don't know what you don't know. And like you were saying before, in the beginning, to get a person addicted to exercise and really connected with exercise, there has to be a practice of repetition. And it's like coffee. It's like, you know, beer. These are acquired tastes. Exercise is an acquired taste. Most things that require efforts will have incredible rewards. Just like, you know, spicy food, you know? Incredibly rewarding to eat spicy food. I wish I had started eating spicy food when I was younger, because it's. So the idea again is the exposure, I think, helps. So if you're someone who exercises, try and you know, support a friend who doesn't exercise. You know, say like completely do what they do. I've got a friend of mine who's terrible. He challenges people who don't exercise. And then he pushes himself to be like, look at how strong I am. And of course, then they puke their guts out or something like that on the assault bike. And you're like, was that really necessary? Would you think that they were at a level where they could handle that? Like, have you just messed up their mind in terms of exercise? Like, they would be like, I'll never exercise again. It's terrible. You know? So it's always like, how do we create good experiences for others with exercise? And it usually comes back down to like, get people interested in exercise through things that bring pleasure or interest. It's that simple. Just love what you do, you know?
With the spicy food comment, is that like, are you referring to like a dopamine release or something when you kind of experience the pain and then kind of swing the other way? Or are you talking about something else?
No. Like, yeah. Building up a tolerance to spicy food is incredible. And like the benefits that it has on your body as well is incredible. But this is just my personal experience, my personal preference. Came to London, tikka masala was the standard, and it was spicy for me. I couldn't handle it. Mm-hmm. And then I graduated to like Rogan Josh, and then, you know, that was still super spicy for me, and I couldn't handle it. And then I went to live in Thailand for a year, where the locals kept forgetting that I ordered like foreigner food, you know, tourist level spice, and they kept giving me local level spice and burnt my palate for a year. And that was terrible. Yes, that was absolutely not progressive overload. That was a very, very large oversight in people serving me food. But when I came back to London, I could handle, you know, a Madras and then up to Vindaloo's, you know, and there's so much flavor that comes once you are able to basically handle the heat. the heat doesn't burn and you have a pain sensation. The heat actually just opens up the entire palate. And for anyone who's curious about this, I'd recommend having something like some chili flakes or something like that, something that's a little bit spicy, and put it in your mouth before you have a cup of coffee.
Okay.
You know, 5 minutes before a cup of coffee, have a little bit of chili or something like that, you know, just enough for you to tolerate. You don't have to burn yourself or anything like that. And just notice how it changes the flavor profile of the coffee. That's what I'm talking about.
Ah, okay. Very cool. Yeah, I've just started ordering like the next sort of spicy thing from like the Indian. And yeah, it is kind of becoming a bit of a, like you said, graduation where I'm like, you know, I really want to kind of get to that next level. It's almost a personal challenge. I don't like that it's defeating me. You know, it's like I need to be able to eat you.
Yeah.
Forget jiu-jitsu belts. Now it's going to be just which curry level you've attained. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
When I first thought about this kind of conversation, Justin, I did mention to you that it would be good to provide some kind of generic recommendations for people in relation to flexibility and strength and cardio. And now as we're having the conversation, I'm realizing that that's probably not a good idea. And only because the way that you work is like, you want to know why someone's doing something, right? Like, what are your goals? What are you looking to achieve? Where are you at? Yeah. Like whenever someone's working with you, it starts with this kind of deep dive into like, what are you actually doing and where are you? And in a way, like providing kind of generic templates may actually not serve someone as well as like actually them spending the time figuring out exactly what they want to be doing.
Right. Yeah.
So do you agree with that? Do you think that there's some wisdom to that?
I think 100% yes. And in the same breath, I think that there are some broad strokes, which are pretty easy to hit anyway.
Right.
You know, but again, it's like take the broad strokes and apply your personal interests to the broad strokes. So the broad strokes for me in resistance training are push, pull, hinge, squat, four movement types.
Hinge, squat. Right.
Right. So a push can be push-ups, but if you don't like push-ups and you've got a gym membership, then you go onto the machines, you know? Or if you don't like push-ups, but you're obsessed with gymnastics rings, then you do ring push-ups or ring dips, you know? So you can do body weight, but if you don't like that type of stuff, you know, and you like barbells, you know, bench press is a push. So the application of it for exercise is that you're doing any movement that is pushing a weight away from you or pushing you away from something else, right? So it's a push movement, nice and easy. But the application of that is just, where do you take it? You know, for me, it's body weight. I love body weight. But even within body weight, we've got weighted calisthenics. You've got freestyle calisthenics, you've got endurance calisthenics, and then you still have like skills-based calisthenics where they're doing like front levers and planches and things like that, right? So there's all these categories of like, you know, categories underneath a category anyway.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like you've got Olympic lifting. Well, Olympic lifting does a pull and a push simultaneously. There's usually a squat involved and a hinge involved as well. But there's usually no rotational movement in that. And there's usually no unilateral movement in that as well. So you've got two movements, but you're leaving out a host of other movements. So in terms of this, it's just an exploration of push, pull, hinge, squat. What do you like? What do you want to do? And what are some ways that you can just shake it up anyway? Because the quantity of it. Did you do any push exercises last week? No. Okay, cool. Let's do some this week. How much can you do? How much do you want to do? All right. Cool. Now that you've laid that down, the next time you come back to it, let's say in 3 months, can you do more? So if we take a very simple approach, we don't need a perfect program. It's just a matter of like, what can I do that's going to be, you know, simulating pushing movements, pulling movements, and then how can I progressively overload this? How can I be better 6 months down the road, a year down the road? And better sometimes just means the same number, but more control. So think about pull-ups, like maybe in a year, you can still do the same number of pull-ups today as a year from now, but a year from now, your control and your mastery of those movements is going to be, you know, you'll see a noticeable difference. So yeah, I think that's the broad strokes for, you know, resistance training, a pull, a push, a hinge, a squat, and it's up to you. But remember that there's a certain amount of that that you need to be able to stimulate a response from your body. You know, so what is that stimulation? So we can talk about going to failure or near failure to stimulate muscle growth. Mm-hmm. We can talk about frequency to stimulate muscle growth. We can also talk about training, you know, 0 to 5 reps to stimulate strength adaptations, not size adaptations. Size adaptations usually are anywhere between 6 to 30 reps if you go according to the science. So, you know, you go deeper into the rabbit hole as you go down. But the first thing is make a choice to go down the rabbit hole. Pull, push, hinge, squat. It's pretty easy.
And what about simple broad strokes in relation to cardio, the value of VO2 max, and then also while you're there in that area, flexibility and mobility?
So the value of VO2 max is according to, you know, Professor Dr. Peter Attia, it's the number one marker that'll improve your longevity and quality of life. And VO2 max is the volume of oxygen that can be maximally consumed by your body when you're doing rigorous activity. And so just getting yourself, you know, from below average or average to above average in VO2 max is going to extend your life and your capacity. It's going to be a game changer. Simple answer is pick a cardio exercise, whether it be cycling, running, stationary, you know, like in a gym, it doesn't matter. All cardio matters, you know, because in the capacity of just do something that you think is cool, that you like, that you want to do more of, put your emotion behind it, and you're going to find much more enjoyment. So the concept there is that, again, it's quantity. You know, last week I ran for 10 minutes. This week I ran for 15 minutes. Next week I ran for 20 minutes. And the week after that, I decided to do 2 days of running, you know? So be gentle with yourself in the beginning if you're starting out. And if you're starting out, just measure your quantity. How much running did I do last week? So even if I did a minute of running this week, it's more than 0 minutes of running last week. That's a win. But then that means next week you got to do 2 minutes, you know? So be sure that you're choosing something that you look forward to, you enjoy, and you'll progressively get stronger and better at it. And it'll start to become part of your identity. The slower you take it, the more it becomes part of your identity as well. So that's, yeah, cardio.
Yeah. Okay. I've had some conversations with you about this, but I just want to clarify for people listening. Is it realistic to make changes to our VO2 max, you know, or is this something that we're kind of born with and, you know, you can make like 2% improvements, but, you know, the people that are the distance runners are the distance runners and that's just them and it's genetic and...
Oh, yeah. So, you know, VO2 max is pretty much like, yes, genetically scripted. You know, if you have the genes for it, you're never going to be above a certain number or whatever.
Right.
That's true. Yeah, 100%. But the expression of your body is never going to be uniform. Your VO2 max depends on your conditioning throughout your life. So if you stop doing exercise, your VO2 max is going to go down. You know, if you exercise more, your VO2 max is going to go up. So it's all relative to you as well. As much as, you know, genes load the gun, habits pull the trigger.
Mm.
And so what are your habits? So even if your VO2 max, genetically speaking, is programmed to be crap, by you habitually exercising, you're probabilistically changing your fate, essentially to be, you know, live longer, live healthier, better quality of life later on as well.
Yeah.
And realistically speaking, you can change your VO2 max in a very short space of time, but it requires a lot of vigorous activity rounds where you're putting in hard work, as much work as you can manage for the entire round. 3 minutes up to 8 minutes per round. They say that the optimum is the one that we talked about, which is it's called the Norwegian high interval training protocol, which is 4 rounds of intense exercise with 3 minutes of rest between each round, or 4 minutes of rest, depending on where you source it from. So ultimately you're doing like 28 to 32 minutes of exercise with breaks included. And it is incredibly fatiguing, incredibly fatiguing. And you will see results with just one session a week. you know. But again, if we're going back down to broad strokes, to go from nothing to training that type of protocol, you will throw up. You will be faint. You will hate it. You will hate your experience. But, you know, unless you're, I suppose, masochistic in some way. But how about going from nothing to running down your street and walking back? How about going from nothing and, you know, jogging with a friend for 5 minutes and then, you know, saying, hey, I'll catch you back at the car. You know, those types of things. Being around environments that also promote a lot more exercise. You know, if you are a result of the people and the influences around you, put people around you whose habits you're happy to let influence you. So put healthier people around you so that you are the least healthy person. You know, that idea of like, if you have 5 fat friends, you're about to be the 6th. But if you have 5 healthy friends, you're about to be the 6th, you know? So,
personal anecdote and update. So I've done 4 sessions now of the Norwegian split program that you've just outlined. And today, actually, a couple of hours ago, I did jiu-jitsu. And I was sparring a couple of very fit MMA fighters. You know, they fight regularly. And I was like waiting, like, when am I going to get tired? And I was like, not really coming. And it was like, okay, when is the round is done? When am I going to be like, oh my God, I'm glad it's over. Didn't really happen, you know? And that's like the first little, like little sign of like, okay, there's something that's changing. And to be honest, like when you do this type of split, you realize, at least I realized, it's like jiu-jitsu is not as hard as this in terms of like cardiovascular. Like you can find little spaces to have a breather. But the point of this high-intensity training is that you do the opposite. You're always looking for ways to push. And mentally, that changes things as well. You know, you have to kind of dig
it does.
And just find.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a friend of mine that he and I are working on this idea of like, how do we change unhealthy habits for healthy habits? So, you know, drinking games that you usually play, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, every time she slays a monster, you have a drink or something like that. But what if you're doing a watch party like that? Instead of drinking, you do push-ups or something like that. Or someone calls out an exercise and you have to do that, you know, 5 times every time, you know, the slayer slays or whatever. And it's always like that. And so one of the things is about like, how do we spend time together as friends, but do exercise that's really sucky to do on your own as well? And so he's literally taken assault bike sprint protocols and just invited friends and be like, come on, let's make a thing of it. Let's just suffer together. And it comes back to that idea of connections really help, you know, traumatic instances create better connections.
Yeah.
You know, because ultimately you suffer together and you know that you've shared this thing that other people won't understand. So yeah, I think that's huge. Yeah. To answer your question, by the way, on the flexibility thing is that there are several styles on flexibility as well. Like, are you doing flexibility to get strong in those ranges? Are you doing flexibility to try and extend and open those ranges? You know, are you doing flexibility for exercise or relaxation is the first one. You know, just like breath work, flexibility work can work in the same way. And so the one that I suggest to people is having a stretch before bed, which means getting into positions where you're stretching yourself that you could fall asleep in, essentially. Mm. And chilling out there for, let's say, 2 minutes, or if you're timing it with your breathing before bedtime as well, an inhale of, let's say, 4 seconds and an exhale of 6 seconds, that's already 10 seconds. So do that for, you know, 5 to 10 breaths per position and just try and relax and just fall asleep and tell your body to just relax and fall asleep. And you know, in terms of helping your sleep, that type of flexibility really helps you to relax. It lengthens the muscles. It gets rid of a lot of like muscle tension. Does it really help in terms of extending your flexibility? Not really. In a passive sense, it might, because, you know, you have to collect like 5 minutes of 30-second holds throughout the week to be able to say that you've extended a range. But usually you have to sit in a discomfort of 8 out of 10 discomfort and pain.
Wow.
To get that kind of gain. And so, well, if you're going to do that, why don't you just do ballistic and loaded stretching anyway, which usually has stronger returns on the time invested. So, you know.
I think I'm going to make a guess, but I think most people listening to this when it comes to flexibility would probably want the range of motion that they had when they were like in their 20s or something. You know how you can kind of lose your range of motion? It's not so much that they want to be doing pancakes, but they just want to be able to move their body as it's meant to be moved. You know, does that still apply what you just said about the, it's very hard to get there or?
In terms of like, you know, increasing your range of motion, the kind of like sitting in it for 2 minutes and relaxing, it's not really going to do it. It might if you do it for a very long period of time, very frequently as well, like on a daily basis, twice a day, you know, sure, you'll get there. Mm-hmm. You know, throw enough spaghetti at the wall, some of it's going to stick. Sure. 100%. And it's just a matter of quantity. But if you want to get dialed into your training, you can get dialed in. So the reason why I recommended that is because that form of stretching feels great. Where most people have like an aversion to stretching because it sucks, doesn't feel good. So this type of stretching, you just put yourself in a position that feels good and you stay there for a couple of minutes enjoying it and breathing. And then from there, you could then graduate into, all right, I'm ready to extend my range of motion into something that it used to be like, oh, I used to be able to touch my toes and I can't now. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Let's get to toe touches, right? What does that look like? You know, so like I said before, there are other methods of stretching that are going to be far faster and train the strength up a lot more than just going into that position and holding it for 30 seconds.
Right. Are there any resources or tools that you have found useful or that you recommend people look at? People's thinkers, you know, anything like that?
I don't recommend any because they all didn't work for me. So I would recommend that people follow their passion. So if they find someone that they think is cool, that they like, yeah, jump in there and explore it and iterate on it and be like, huh, you know what? I like this, but I want to explore something else and I want to explore something else. And so we go back to those positive emotions, you know? And so basically it's the idea of exploration, curiosity. Follow that. Follow your passion.
Yeah.
I spent over, I think it's about $9,000 with various courses and experts and personal coaches to coach me, like one-to-one or group, or, you know, I bought their course or whatever. And I can't tell you how much it was, just a lot of it just didn't work for me. It was a waste of time. Waste of time. Because most of them, if not 99% of them, were saying the same stuff, which was, okay, so you want to get flexible? Okay, I'm going to prescribe you these 17 exercises that's going to take an hour each day minimum. I'm like, how about I give you the finger and you give me my phone call, you know, to quote The Matrix. Classic. Like I was just, this is stupid. Yeah, I could write a program where I'm just going to throw enough volume at it and I'll get a result. But I didn't want to invest that. I wanted to be smarter. So, you know, if a person wants to kind of really open things up, yeah, throw enough volume at it and you're going to see returns. Your body is going to respond to that stimulus.
Okay. And now the million-dollar question, what if someone's listening to you and they're like, okay, well, I want to learn from you and I want you to give me some guidance on all of these things. What's the best way to kind of get in touch or pick your brain, ask questions? And I know you're very... If someone comes to you and they want to talk to you, I know you're generally open to that and you like to kind of to engage.
Yeah. So I'm actually not taking on any like clients or anything like that, but I'm always open to having conversations and helping people out. Mm-hmm. You know, I predominantly work with corporations and corporate entities now. But I do have a course that talks about all the emotional stuff that we've been talking about as well. So that's always open. And I will be running a cohort through that course, you know, like AMAs and things like that. And just like opening up office hours through that course. So that's usually the easiest way. I think apart from that, it's just messaging me saying, hey, asking questions. Like I'm just like anyone else. I will respond. I'll say hi. And, you know, we'll definitely be interested in helping and giving back. So, yeah.
Can you share any like logistical details about the course? Do you have any dates yet, or is it still in development and that's being fleshed out?
No, it's been going already. It's had, you know, a couple people passing through it already.
Yeah.
It's the logistical details. It's three phases. Phase one is getting out of your own way and making sure that we're dealing with your like negativity bias, survivalship bias, whatever the negative emotions are that you technically go to in your patterns. Phase two is how do we turn up positive resources and positive emotional patternings? And then phase three is about how do we include past and future and unify them together to bring you into like a little bit more of an integrated experience. Like if I asked you, what are the top three experiences that you had in your entire life that have defined you? You know, very few people have thought about that. Mm. Very few people will have an answer. And those are the kinds of questions that I'm like, look at the shape of your life. Look at the shape of your life and own it. So, yeah.
Well, when you asked me that question just then, I did remember that we've done three podcasts together. So, you know. Yeah. But no, that's a really profound question. Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
So, yeah. So, a lot of it is just basically, you know, if you think about it, it's turn down negative, turn up positive, and then let's look at your life with those lenses. And so, yeah, that's the course essentially. How do we stay on point, and how do we do all these things? And the support is more important. It's packaged into 20 lessons with a lot of work and a lot of prompts to do as well. Logistically speaking, I think it's super cool because you get to actually have discussions with friends, family members, etc. I designed it to be something that's interactive, that involves the people in your life as well. And I think that's the big difference, the big selling point there.
Yeah. And when it comes to this kind of stuff, I kind of like want to remind people that when I interact with you, Justin, I kind of feel like you give this impression to me, at least, where everything's always been good. You know, you come across as like, you've always been the kind of happy, popular guy and, you know, like good, you know what I mean? Like you come across with that kind of like leadership and you make people feel comfortable and, you know, you're the one that we can look to and ask for guidance in the room, you know, that you come across as that kind of figure. But it's kind of crazy when you actually share that you have changed a lot over the years. You know, you gave some examples today of being almost like crippled with this kind of pain of feeling rejection. That's almost impossible to think about now. I can't, like, the person I'm speaking to now, I can't imagine that happening. So it's kind of crazy that you've gone through this. And I just think that's worth reminding. It's like, you don't really want to be getting ideas and advice from people that have never really gone through anything. I've never really done the work. It's like, I've always had a six pack. Let me teach you how to get six pack abs. It's like, no, it's better to talk to the person who used to be obese and then got six pack abs. Like that's the transformation there. Yes. They can teach you.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear that. Yeah, I really do. I think, ultimately, I think it also depends on the person. You know, we come down to the same thing, you know. If you don't like my face, my content's not going to be relevant to you because you'll have a bias against me. But you know, if you don't mind my face, then it's gonna work. But if you enjoy my face, that's gonna sell, you know, all of my ideas. So yeah.
All right.
Personal preference. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll include links to everything. I think the show notes to this episode are going to be pretty intense. There's going to be a lot of concepts and yeah, there's going to be a lot. I'm looking forward to digging through it all. thanks. Also want to shout out Mark. Thank you for joining and providing some great questions and challenging Justin, a much needed battle that happened that I had to kind of step in and moderate a little bit.
Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure to be, you know, witnessing you two, podcast intellectual giants, I might say. It's been a pleasure to be involved in the conversation and I feel like this is one of my favorite podcasts. I get to sort of sit there and also occasionally ask a question in real time, which is pretty cool. You know? It's the sort of podcasting listener experience deluxe right here.
That's a good way to look at it, actually. Yeah, John, you'd have to do a live version at some point, I suppose.
Yeah, we'll have to figure that out. So thank you, Justin. Thanks for sharing your wisdom and providing the time and giving value. I've learned a lot, and I've had a lot of fun. So appreciate you.
Yeah. Likewise, I've had a lot of fun. Thanks for thinking of me and having this conversation. It's been great. I loved it. Thank you.
I hope that you enjoyed that, took some value from it. Couple of quick things. If you can leave a rating for the podcast wherever you're listening to it, that really helps new people find it. And I also love reading reviews, so let me know what you think about it. And if you want to go further and get access to all of my premium meditations and audio courses, Ask Me Anythings, workshops, etc., consider subscribing to Stoic Handbook Premium with a free trial, either directly within Apple Podcasts or over at stoichandbook.supercast.com. It's the same thing, just two different ways to access it. And I'll see you back here for the next episode of the Stoic Handbook Podcast.